Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. And we are an affiliate of the network. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Hey everyone, and welcome to Gather Round. I'm Ruthanna Marte Fio, and we have segments from people all across the United States tonight. It's really cool area to San Diego, Nashville, Tampa. Hey, we're all here. And I'm very excited because our first segment is Tea Talk with Monique is from HealthyWomensInternational.com and also Johnson.com. And welcome, Monique.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. It truly is an honor.
I'm so glad that you're here and you're going to this segment because you work with energies. And as soon as I saw you doing tea talks on YouTube and on which you on YouTube or websites, I thought, wow, she is into chakras. She gets it. She understands energy. And it was like, okay, let's see what this woman can do. And, well, you put out the vibe in the first place.
Yeah.
So, you know, have you always been that way, or did it take you a while to come to it?
I would say when I was younger, I had a lot of wounds to heal. And as I, you know, released some of the stuckness, the baggage, the pain body that I had went through, then it just blossomed more so into the being that I am now. I have always been very compassionate. I've always been very empathetic and, you know, always had a heart for the pains of others' life. I just had to learn how to apply that to myself.
So, but you have done, I would say, quite a job. So I'm going to shut up and let you tea talk.
Okay, well, very good. I like to thank anyone who's listening because obviously they're sharing their tea time with me. Of course, I was introduced. You can find me MoniqueJohnson.com, M-O-N-I-E-K. And today I was what was on my heart is before we go into more detail of the chakras and how to self-discern what is going on with your personal chakras and begin to do the work, quote unquote, one of the things I like to prep people with or to help people to get a firm foundation for going through this information is to, quote unquote, how to become your own guru. In the business world that I work in, and in many of the trainings I went through in yoga and meditation, holistic health, massage, and any of the energy trainings I went through, it was very important in my journey for me not to give over all of my power to a being that happened to be in the training. What was the most healthy spot for me to be in was to partner with them, to collaborate, and for me to learn the information, to see what resonated, because the only thing that's true in the moment is what resonates, and then to use what resonated and to move forward with that kind of information. And unfortunately, sometimes when I would be in the yoga trainings, that life tool, that way of experiencing training and life, kind of got lost in translation, and then you had ones who had self-identities of being a guru, and then the ones who came in, they kind of woo-woo and gave their power to that person. And there's nothing wrong with that. I do not judge that at all, or the people who are in the midst of that experience. That's a choice. But from where I am, from where I am speaking, I am not in any way trying to increase the shackles or crutches that we use in life. What the information that I will go through ongoing during this segment will be for ones to kind of experience what I'm saying, see for themselves what their inner teacher tells them about that, and it really is at this point just about awakening awareness. And as we awaken our awareness in life, in our conditionings, in the chakras, the energy centers, in our blocks, in whatever we're doing, if we awaken the awareness first to just be able to see it clearly, then to put the intelligence with it so that we can see, okay, once I've seen it clearly, how does that manifest in my life, in my thoughts, in my beliefs, in my perceptions? Once we put those things together, then, and I mentioned, I think, last week, then you have the consciousness, and once you are in the midst of that consciousness, then you can expand and let go. So that is how I mirror to be your own guru. So as we move forward through all the tea talks we do together and all the information and, you know, and eventually hopefully we'll get it to where it's a question and answer as well, remember to honor your own experience of life. To honor your own, one, belief system at the present time, realizing that belief systems are more to be fluid, so that when I have an intention in life, a umbrella of intention of what I would like to experience in life, all the beliefs fit underneath that umbrella. So then you can take a belief off and put another one on when it works towards the bigger intention of life. So that is just kind of a foundation that I really wanted to build as a basis. And what that does as it relates to chakras is it begins to help a person to become aware of their third chakra, which is the energy center, the power center, the solar plexus, and it deals with empowerment. It is our power center of the body. And, of course, we can give our power away, which there's nothing wrong with that, especially there's really, you know, as long as you're conscious, you're doing it, it's all good. And then we can empower ourselves, which is bringing that ability to create and to change things and all of that, get honoring the ability that we have as creators of our life. So we have the choice to do that. And what I am just saying is that my choice in what I do is to empower and not to, because I don't need your power. you give your power away and half the time your person you give it to don't know what to do with it. Because if they take your power when you're giving it, a lot of times there's a deficit there anyway. So I just really wanted to encourage us to do that. And then eventually what I would like to do with this segment, and we'll start next week, is we'll start to walk through the chakras. We'll start with the first one, which is the root. And next week we'll talk about the root chakra if everything stays stable. and I say that because I always leave openness and space for life. Life is constantly moving, and when I, in my life, I have found when I attach to any specific thing, you know, if even in this moment I'm like, okay, this is what we're going to talk about, this is the goal, that's what I, you know, then if I attach to it, then it condenses me down. So I am making the intention to talk about the chakras from the first one on up all the way through to the seventh, and spend a little time on each one so you can, one, begin to first open awareness, see it clearly. Second, bring in your innate intelligence without the ego driving to build consciousness. And then at that point, you can really self-discern and start to unblock any blockages or pain bodies that have been embraced in the energy centers. And it's going to be fun. Most of all, we want to have fun. At least I do. So hopefully we'll be doing a lot of laughing and really just have a little time for you to be with yourself in your journey of life with compassion and non-judgment. The awareness we are awakening is compassionate self-awareness. And at that place, we really are, I will be encouraging every step of the way to release any self-judgments, because even judgment, shame, blame, guilt, all of those are energies that begin to clog the chakras. So every step of the way, I will be encouraging you to embrace whatever it is you see in the mirror from the things we talk about, to accept it 100%, to embrace it because it is. It just is. And then once you self-discern and look at your intention of life, then you may decide, hey, I think I'd like to evolve that or transform that or let that go or integrate it. And if you do it from a place of love and compassion and acceptance of self, any changes you make will last, because it's not being made from a place of self-hatred or self-denial, self-betrayal, all that stuff. It's coming from a place of love for your soul. And so your soul's like, hey, you want to do it that way? Fine, cool, it's good. And it starts to really support you in life the whole way. So that is where we will, my intention of where we will go with our tea talks here in the morning, in the beginning of this, of our session here. And I always encourage people, if you're a tea person, grab your tea before you start listening. And, you know, if you're a coffee person, grab that. And, of course, we could all use some water.
Okay, right. We're saying grab your liquid of choice.
Yes.
At the time. actually, I had some caramel tea, which is interesting.
Yeah, really.
So, I love the taste of caramel, and before I became vegan, I would have lots of caramel things sometimes, but this tea is just, I don't know what they flavored it with. Actually, quite nice. So I love tea also, like you.
Beautiful, yes.
I love coffee too. I have to admit, I'm a coffee snob. So,
yes.
And
my husband, he is a coffee person, but since we got together, he does tea as well. He was not a tea person. And I'm like, you know, go with what you like, what your flavor. As long as your body is not saying you need to do something differently, then it's like, enjoy it. You know, I per se just have never enjoyed coffee. I remember when I was in corporate, I've been out of corporate for going on 4 years, about 3 years now, and I would make myself drink it for the effect. But I never got to a point that my taste palate enjoyed it. So I'm not really a coffee girl. Every so often I'll have a cappuccino or something if we're doing an after dinner drink with my boo. But it's really for communion. It's not for taste.
That's funny. Yeah, when I first started drinking, I had to have the milk and sugar, and then I got rid of one and then the other, and it's like, okay, I really like good emphasis.
Yeah.
Organic fair trade shade grown coffee beans that I grind myself. I have a friend who's like you. She loves the way it smells.
Yes.
But when the coffee, she won't do it. She's tried it and didn't like it, but she loves the smell. But but I just love the idea of tea time. And what it's really good, I think, that impressed me, because you. That is your choice.
Yeah.
that's good. I want to end on that note because we hear so much about how bad it is to give your power away. But like you're saying, as long as you're conscious of it, there may be times when that works better.
Yes.
As long as you're conscious, just go ahead. I wouldn't say to, I don't think that's healthy, but sometimes it just creates some problems to do it, or just let somebody take over for a little while if you're just needing that break. So that I think that was very that was something good, and we should think about that a bit more, I believe. But I'm very excited next week.
Beautiful. I am very excited to return.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Oh, it is a pleasure. And yes, thank you for reiterating that. I love that part of it. I mean, that's where we're going, hopefully, is to a place to where all choices are open. Just be conscious which one you make and be responsible for the outcome.
Responsibility, yes. I know we're going to talk about that.
Responsibility.
So thank you so much.
Very good. Thank you so much for inviting me, and I will see y'all next week.
Right. Monique, that's MONIEK.com.
Awesome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And Al Suarez is here. Hello, Al.
Hey, am I like live right now, or?
Yeah, we're live. The show's on. Yeah. I had messaged you, but I guess you didn't get it. Blog Talk said that they were having trouble with the call-in, and so I was cut in. So they were working on it. Obviously, it worked. So I wanted to say you have just written a book called Solidarity Forever with a question mark, The Struggle of an Occupier. Now, this book can be found on Amazon. Is there any other place or any other site that you would like to?
Well, it's also on Kindle and on CreateSpace.
Oh, okay. Kindle and CreateSpace.
Right, CreateSpace.com.
Yeah, okay. So it's getting around. Ask, did you, were you into politics? I mean, your whole life, were you on the edge of activism or past few years?
Pretty much as I was a teenager, but before we get into questions, if you don't mind, I'd like to read the brief description of the book that can be found on Amazon.
I would like to wait until we get to the book for that.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. I have a couple questions before we get to the book then.
So tell me about...
I'm sorry?
Tell me about your background. You said
sure.
That you were...
I've been a political activist since I was 17 years old. I went to my first protest to protest the intervention in Afghanistan. We were revealing the oil pipeline plans that they... had there, and that protest took part in was in Burlington, Vermont, and Burlington, Vermont also happened to be the first occupied camp that I stayed on, so it's one of the first chapters in the book. So I have some origins in New England, but I live in Florida now, but I try to take part in protests wherever I am. I've been lived abroad for some time, took part in marches and stuff there. Yep.
Occupied first, actual active, what I want to say, protest, demonstration, pardon?
What about protests and demonstrations?
Was Occupy first that you got involved in?
Well, yeah, right after I was at the camp in Burlington, after that camp was shut down, within a couple weeks I went to Occupy Boston, which was the major...
My question...
Occupy New England. Yeah.
Listen to my question, please. My question was Occupy the first active work that you got involved in? I'm just trying to get a background here before we get into the book.
Well, yeah, I've never gone to daily protests like I did until Occupy was around. It was
did
never really a movement that was in place in the United States where you go to a protest every single day. We were very active.
That wasn't my question. My question. Did you ever go to any other protests ever write articles? Did you ever do anything like that?
I just described the very first protest I went to when I was 17 years old.
Okay.
So that was a few years before Occupy.
Right, definitely. Occupy. Not that you're that old, but I mean, it was several years. But Occupy, actually up and down the East Coast, I think, pretty much.
I was throughout the country, but yeah, I took part in a lot of camps up and down the East Coast.
Yeah. And I know, I just before you read about the book, tell me what made you decide.
What made me decide to join Occupy?
No, what made you decide to write the book after you had joined?
Okay, I'm sorry, you were breaking up. To write the book. Two factors, mainly. Number one, it's a side of the story of the movement that you don't normally hear.
Okay.
I've read all the literature, including Chomsky, on Occupy, and, you know, these are intellectuals, people that were part of the movement, that were supporters of the movement. I haven't found any work from somebody who's been thoroughly in the movement like I was, who's actually written about it. So I wanted to show that side, and then the number two factor was that there's been a lot of accusations against me and other activists that have left the movement, false accusations, and this was a book kind of to respond to that so they could see my side of what really went down.
Okay.
So it's for history, for people to know, you know, the experiences from the movement and to learn from it, you know.
Okay. It makes a learning experience. What exactly does Amazon say? If you click your book, what's it going to say as far as about it?
Right. This is the description I have in front of me. So it says here, my book is a unique insight into the movement. Few have known from deep inside the movement that shows the mistakes that were made that can be corrected to make an even better movement. I was practically on every Occupy camp in the East Coast. Occupy started as a movement to fight Wall Street corruption, but expanded into a multi-cause front. Internal disputes, infiltration, and other factors caused the movement's demise. This book is written by a controversial figure who is finally telling his side. Solidarity Forever was a song I sang with my comrades the two times I was arrested. There are different versions of the song. I put a question mark, as it seems there's a lack of solidarity in what remains of the movement. That is why my title starts that way, and this is an attempt to show what really happened, as no one else has dared written from my first edition.
Okay. So what kind of response have you gotten from the people who have looked this over so far? I mean, I know it's just brand new out, but what have you got?
It's been out for about a week, but what was the other part of the question?
What kind of a response? What have people said who've looked it over?
Oh, yeah. I mean, positive, but I'm expecting whenever I do my book tour to get negative responses from people that haven't read it or have only read parts of it, because a lot of people assume that it's an anti-Occupy book, and that's not true. It shows both the good and the bad. Okay, it's a truthful book. It's not pro-Occupy propaganda, nor is it anti-Occupy propaganda.
Right, and this is a relatively short book, so it
yeah, it's first edition. Yeah. My first book I ever published. I've written for a long time, but I never actually wrote a book. Yeah.
I was going to say, you've written a lot about Occupy during the whole 2 years. My God, Al, it's been almost 2 years.
Absolutely. There's articles in there that when it was fresh in my mind,
okay,
I put those in there to give it context.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so some of what, I mean, if we started out at the beginning reading what you wrote, we'll see some of that.
Definitely, because there's things that are fresh in your mind in those times that you're going to forget when you're just recollecting. So if you use the articles you wrote at that time, it gives it context.
Yeah. A lot of people, you know, it's amazing to me, and I think it is to you too, but we know there are people who still do not know about Occupy. And
yeah. They know what happened in Egypt, but they don't know about the United States, their own country.
Well, the ones I'm talking about don't know what happened in Egypt either. So what does that tell you? It was just a few months ago. I was saying something about Occupy and what about. And this, actually, it's a relative of mine, said, what are you talking about? What was Occupy? And I just had to breath and, you know, keep from screaming. But so would you tell us how Occupy worked? We hear about GA, which stands for General Assembly.
Right.
People aren't familiar with exactly what that is. Would you just go over that briefly for us?
To be honest, I never really liked GA. I prefer DA, which is direct action, or also known as autonomous action, because the GA is an assembly where it's a consensus-based so-called horizontal democracy. And there's a lot of contradictions there that I point out in the book. And during the movement, I was critical of some things. And as a result, a lot of people lodged accusations against me, a lot of immaturity, a lot of lack of organization. But what it's supposed to do is help, you know, get actions and implement those actions by consensus-based. And most of the General Assembly took place on the camps. Some Occupy cities didn't have a camp, like Occupy Savannah. I was down in Georgia when we first started. So, yeah, I mean, they have a General Assembly, and they can be very controversial. I describe a lot of General Assembly that took part in the book. It was a rough time in my life, but it was a learning experience and something that I think others can learn from as well.
Well, a lot of the General Assemblies that I've heard about, a lot were taken over by certain. There were the anti-men groups, and on and on. And, you know, I've never, people who know me know I've never been a fan of consensus necessarily, because I've seen too much bullying in it.
Absolutely. Mob rule. They kicked out people in the movement that way, and I describe that in detail.
Yeah. I'm big on actually voting, and it's like if against you, well, that's fine. You can still be in the group, and you don't have to participate in the action. I think that sometimes consensus gets things watered down too much.
I never facilitated, for example. I would never want to be a facilitator of a General Assembly. It's extremely difficult.
No.
Especially when we have several hundred people in a major Occupy in Boston, we have to facilitate. You know, those numbers have diminished now, and that, I don't even know if they're still having General Assemblies in Boston. But when the movement was first starting, there was a lot of people, a lot of students, sometimes over 1,000 people. And, you know, they tried to block people from speaking, and it was just very controversial. And it went, like, it was GA supposed to be 2 hours. It went into 5 hours. It went into, like, I don't know, 1 a.m. when the train goes and people need their rides homes. Like, it went into all night, like a lot of controversial proposals about banning people. And some of them I support. I actually do agree with banning people that are dangerous to the movement, but they have to be, has to be substantial. It can't be based on rumors. It has to be evidence. And like I said, a lot of false accusations were brought against people, and people were excluded. And it was about internal fighting. It wasn't about fighting the system, which was what we were supposed to have a consensus on.
Well, right. I mean, like, there's supposed to be unity against the big evil, actually, instead of breaking up smaller issues. And I know everybody thinks that their own issue is huge, but, you know, we need to get a perspective and the problem. So we're anti that. So, like, let's stand united on that one and work to overthrow whatever we're going to do. Then we can work on these individual issues. But
you got to be careful about the lingo too, right? Because you're going to say, I want to violently overthrow the government or whatever. Like, we're supposed to be nonviolent.
No.
But at the same time, you got the FBI calling, activists domestic terrorists. And they've been doing this for years, since before Occupy, like the green activists, you know, the environmentalists.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, well, now, if you say something against, you can be called a terrorist. I mean, you know, they've blown everything out of proportion. But give us some of your good experiences, would you, with Occupy?
Sure. One of the greatest experiences of my life, and I will never deny this, was the first major act of civil disobedience I did in my life. And that was when, on December 10th, 2011, 46 of us locked arms and defended camp. And we had enough. We said, we're not leaving. You know, we were abandoned. You know, everybody was gone. Most of the tents were gone. The police overwhelmed us, but we stood our ground and we stayed there till the end. And that was just a beautiful experience. It was a very sad experience that we lost our camp and that we were thrown in jail. But it was a beautiful experience that we were able to do that act of defiance for justice.
Right.
You know,
well, that
moment
that we had,
you know?
At that time, it was, and that has to be so. You've come away with a lot of good from it. What did you learn from negativity that you encountered?
Well, I stayed in the spiritual tent in Boston, so it gave me a lot of spiritual strength living in that tent and just the spiritual strength to be able to, against all odds, stand up and I call it the last stance as part of the the Last Stand chapter where I described how we locked arms and, you know, like brothers and sisters, and we held on till the end. It was just a beautiful experience. It's a hard experience to describe unless you've gone through something like that.
Yeah, I've had a couple of those several moments in my life, and it is. It's very, very hard to describe to somebody, but yet you'll never forget it. It'll always be part of you.
And it's very tragic because how the movement fell after that. Like, I thought that by the spring we were going to have a new camp. It was going to be even bigger and better. And now in hindsight, you know, it was all an illusion that, you know, what happened after that, the division, the betrayal. It's really sad. But I think that another movement can come about more organized, you know, people that were part of Occupy, and they can learn from those mistakes that we made collectively.
That's a question that I had, because I know personally some people who were heavily involved in Occupy who are heavily involved now in really changing, making some changes, and some people are being urged to run for office just on a, you know, the local level kind of thing, and they gained experience and confidence. They were empowered by the work they did in Occupy. Do you feel that way?
Yes, but you know what's really ironic, though, Ruthann? Occupy Sandy, I mean, when the movement first started, it was about helping the homeless. That was one of our main objectives. But over time, they said, we're not social workers. We can't help the homeless anymore. And there was internal disputes about the whole homeless issue that I described. But now, Occupy Sandy, I mean, that's all they're doing. You know what I mean? All they're doing is social services ever since Hurricane Sandy. So, and a lot of people are not even occupiers, but the media gave them the Occupy label and they took it, which is fine. But I just find it ironic now that one of the only things that they're doing now in New York is social services.
Yeah, but for a lot of people, it was not an issue. A lot of the occupiers around the country. So where you were, I mean, that was irony that you're talking about. But there again, maybe people have grown, and you know, gotten to. What is your takeaway from Occupy? I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it gave me a lot of spiritual strength.
Okay.
It also made me much more cautious, and let's say less reckless when it comes to activism.
Okay.
That doesn't mean that down the line I might take part in civil disobedience again, but it gives you some wisdom, like, you know, to be a little more conscious when you're doing a little more cautious when you're doing certain actions. And yeah, also build consciousness, you know, because you could say we're all against the system, but you have to provide a solution and make a conscious decision on how you're going to bring about that solution and who you're going to unite with.
Okay, yeah, it's very easy to find something to complain about, God knows, but it doesn't really do any good to just go around bemoaning things without coming up with some kind of solutions. And whether the solution is something you're going to try. So, do you plan on writing some more books?
One of them is about, part of the title is going to be The Unfinished Revolution. Because I really saw Occupy as a revolutionary movement. At least in the beginning, most of them were radicals and revolutionaries because, you know, you had some reformers, some co-opters that came and took over, but you know, the real occupiers in the beginning were people that really wanted a revolutionary change within the society. And I think later on, a movement like that can come about. There may be some, you know, changes in the methods and things like that, adaptation, but that the country does need revolutionary change.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Not the one provided by Obama, if you know what I mean.
I think let's understand that because, well, the Uniparty, being the combination of the Democrats and Republicans, has done nothing good for us in years, if they ever did. And so that is just not even an issue as far as I'm concerned anymore. They've totally screwed it up. But I think that Occupy has been the foundation for a real, real change. It woke people up, except my cousin, relative. But, you know, I mean, a lot of people are more aware now, and because some people were aware of what was going on, but they thought they were the only ones that were discontented. And Occupy showed them that there's more, and that, you know, people can do something. So I really admire it, and I think that it's a great idea to, and then to write another. Have you already started the next one?
Yeah, and then the next one I'm also going to mention, because there's a chapter actually named The Deaths of Chief and Brian Arredondo. And Brian Arredondo was the son of Carlos Arredondo. And, you know, when I first wrote the book, this was before, you know, Carlos Arredondo was, you know, national hero that he is now. But, yeah, in case people don't know, the guy that I met and whose vigil for his dead son I went to, who was part of Occupy, Carlos Arredondo, is a Costa Rican American who was the one that everybody sees in the pictures from the Boston bombing with the cowboy hat saving the kid in the wheelchair. You know, he's an activist. So those type of people that you had on Occupy, people that would run when there's an explosion towards it, not away from it. Very brave and very noble people that I was involved with, that I'm honored to have worked with.
Yeah. No, it's no, like Al said, the book can be found at createspace.com. It's on Kindle. And you can get it at Amazon.com. It's called Solidarity Forever? The Struggle of an Al Suarez. Suarez.
Yeah, a little middle initial there too. Al R. Suarez.
Okay, and Al is also on Facebook, I must say. So.
Absolutely, I'm on Ruth Ann's page. Al Suarez.
Yeah. So there you are. And thank you so much. And keep us informed as to the next book too, Al.
Absolutely. I do want to have a second edition and also a book about the unfinished revolution, hopefully by next year. Thanks for having me.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. It's Al Suarez. Forever, The Struggle of an Occupier. And now we have our very own Cynthia Hamill. She's here, folks. Hi, Cynthia.
Hey, Ruthanne. How are you?
I'm enjoying fall. Still, it's still autumn in Illinois in the middle of summer. But be
wow.
That as it, yeah, this is the second week. And, you know, anybody that says climate change doesn't exist, if somebody was trying to their head is stuck very far. I want to say that you have a show here on the station, Air Martifio, on Monday nights at 6 o'clock. At 7 o'clock Central, 5 Pacific time. And in this, you bring in some of the most interesting guests as people who have who know about the chemtrails, which is one of your areas of expertise, 9/11, people have been, targeted, the TIs, and I wanted to just ask briefly, how did you ever, 5 or 10 years ago, if somebody would have told you you'd be doing this, what would you have said to them?
Wow, you know, I kind of feel like my whole life was leading me to this point, because even when I look back at conversations that I would have with my parents at the dinner table in junior high and high school, when I was like trying to determine what I would major in college and which direction I would take, I was looking at psychology, I was looking at hypnosis training, I was looking at, you know, being a medical doctor possibly, or a veterinarian, or, you know, the atmosphere. I was, you know, there all of this stuff I really was intrigued with and I was interested in, but I didn't know exactly which route to go. I wound up going into college and getting an advertising degree, which laid the foundation where now I can basically do my own blogging and, you know, kind of get the word out on all the stuff that I found out about. I also had a background with, broadcast journalism and journalism through TCU under this Nazi teacher who was excruciatingly, you know, tough when I was taking from her, but she was really preparing me for the work that I'm doing right now. So she was a slave driver. She was driven. She expected the best of everybody in the program. And if I look back at some of the people that really helped me the most, it was that instructor and some other professors that I had, along with some high school instructors, even like Robert Holliday, who was my Brit Lit teacher, who gave us this, you know, tremendous will to kind of learn and develop in the arts and explore things in the arts, because the arts gave me what I've got in order to pursue and push forward what I've learned about with all the stuff I've found out about. It's that type of inspiration that came even from my watercolor classes and my karaoke experiences. All of this stuff is pulling into play.
Well, everything, yeah, it fell into place. But if somebody would have said that you would be blogging and interviewing people on these topics, would you have been surprised? Say 5 years ago, say 10 years ago.
Yeah, I totally would have. I couldn't have guessed what I would be doing right now. It's so far out. I couldn't have imagined this. There's no way, you know.
Yeah, that you would be, you know, conversing with individuals and. You know, I mean, to me, that's just amazing. And most people growing up, even taking that wide, varied background that you did, that you wouldn't have even targeted individuals. Who are you talking about kind of thing? And now you know them.
Yes.
Regularly. So what area of this, your show's called The Research Rabbit Hole with good reason. Because it seems that you may have started out with 9/11 and just you kept going down these little holes and off into other directions and on. So you're so far down there. It would be hard to get out of these holes at this point. But 9/11,
yeah.
I mean, I'm visualizing, you know, you down in some kind of tunnel stuff. But 9/11 was the beginning of this particular part of your life, right?
Yeah, I would say 9/11 was a big eye-opener. The day that happened, it was transformative. It changed my focus. I owe a lot to that date, and I owe a lot to my intuition for giving me the insight that, hey, there's more than what you're seeing on this TV set. There's a lot more to the story, and I kind of had that Nancy Drew part of me that was just like, man, you know, there's too much here that is just not making sense. You know, you need to figure this thing out. This is like a huge Nancy Drew mystery here. It's like the biggest Nancy Drew mystery that has probably ever been on the planet. And, like, don't just sit there. Start researching this stuff. There's more to the story, you know?
Well, I mean, and you have. And, in fact, you're friends with Richard Gage, who is the founder of Just for 9/11 Truth.
Yes.
So, You got some good connections right off, and so you had mentors and teachers and friends who really direction, should we say.
Yes, I have quite an extensive list of activists and influential people within my own 9/11 group in San Diego, as well as the people that are on my national and international activist list on Facebook. So it almost reads like the who's who of activists if you look at it. And I've been very fortunate to make the type of connections that I've had for my radio show interviews and to just rub elbows with these people at certain conferences and stuff like that, to actually meet people in person that I've interviewed and to get to shake their hand and give them a hug and, you know, shoot pictures with them or whatever. And so it's been fabulous.
Because you do go to several conferences regularly.
Yes, I attended the Beyond Chemtrail Conference that happened last year in L.A., and I got to meet several people there. And then, of course, we have Michael Murphy from the San Diego area originally, and now he lives in the L.A. area. So I've actually met him about three times in person and have seen him at numerous events dealing with chemtrails in the San Diego area and then also at that conference. Then I met Clifford Carnicom there, and then most recently I went to the Super Soldier Summit, which was in Henderson, Nevada, right outside of Las Vegas, and met Dr. Robert Duncan, who is a very big part of the targeted individual groups that are going on, and he's written a phenomenal book called Project Soul Catcher, which everybody should read. That book is a mind blower, and it's unbelievable the information that he shares in that about this technology. He was one of the head architects of that technology, so it's such an honor to be a personal friend with him and to have interviewed him. He gave me actually two of the last interviews that he did before he pulled himself off the interview circuit. So it was a real honor to, you know, to actually interview him last year and get two of his last interviews.
Yeah. Well, I want to say that you have is a new blog, right?
Yes, yeah. I've been working on that. I love doing my graphic design stuff and including stories. And I basically started this, and it's called The Research Rabbit Hole, W-H-O-L-E, .blogspot.com. And I started it off just like a journal, you know, basically, where I started it on day one, July 1st, the Chemtrail Chronicles, the Research Rabbit Hole of Discovery, and then I started with one of my first stories that I had way back when I was writing with Hub Pages, and I pulled that into this, you know, this new blog format, and then started from there, and then added, you know, the next thing, what chemtrails really are, the targeting of individuals and microwave warfare, which that article stemmed from Rents.com, what chemtrails really are. So I developed my speech and presentation that I gave 2 weeks ago from the format of creating this blog and trying to create something where when people left my speech that day, they could do their own research and follow up with all the research and links and all the stuff that I had just given during that hour and a half seminar. I wanted them to be able to go home and know exactly where my research went, where God, you know, God forbid, if something ever happened to me, they would know exactly where to go in order to find my research and to know exactly what link, what YouTube to find, where they could exactly find the trail that I was blazing, and they could see where this research was leading and how the patents fall into this and how there's testimonials that I've been gathering, and you know, I've been basically building a case almost like an attorney would, building this as this is a credible story, this is a patented you know, technology, and people need to realize this is far beyond a conspiracy theory. This has U.S. patents dating all the way back to the 1920s as far as the chemtrails go. So under the name of stratospheric aerosol spraying.
My God, almost 100 years. And I know that right before the conference, because you were getting frantic because you wanted all that up.
Yes.
Said, tell people where to go.
I pulled a three-day all-nighter almost. I had 4 hours of sleep before giving that presentation because I was so worried I was going to get up there and just look like an idiot. So I was just like, oh, my gosh, I've got to get this thing going. It's got to be up on the air. I want to be able to scan down and show people on a, you know, on the screen where I'm getting all this information and that there's U.S. patents. And I was just trying to document all my information where I looked credible, you know, where I had all my ducks in a row.
Well, and you said you did a marvelous job. So, I mean, I never had it out. I knew you would. But I know you were getting frantic, but that's not the first three-day all-nighter you've pulled, because when you were writing a couple years ago, you were doing that, and you just wouldn't leave the computer. And, I mean, your poor dogs, they had to practically take you for the walk.
they still get to go out, but we're just not doing the mega walks, you know, like we used to, so...
Yeah, so they don't think much of this new venture.
Yeah, we had a beach day yesterday. So, you know, we go out and we do like a celebratory hour or so at the beach, and it's a bigger deal now, you know, because it's not like such a weekly thing, you know.
But, no, you are spending an awful lot of time on research. What are you yourself? I mean, because let's face it, yes. What are you getting out of it?
Well, you know, just the ability to sleep at night. Because, man, when I, you know, had that intuitive blast about 9/11, that, hey, there's more to the story. You need to figure out what's going on. I could not sleep. And it was just like, okay, you know, this insomnia had taken over my life. And I was like, okay, I've got it. This is my calling. This is like something of purpose. This is kind of what I have to do. So, I mean, just to sleep at night, I'm driven like this. So it sounds crazy, and,
no,
you know, I don't know how long this is going to last, but this is what I've been given to do. So I'm just going with it, you know. I'm just doing what I need to do.
Well, right. I mean, because you on a personal level, you can actually sleep now because, but you must be getting satisfaction also just from sleep, just knowing that you're getting out as much as you possibly can to people who need it, I'm thinking.
Yeah, there is a sense of satisfaction that I feel now, especially after getting this blog up and running and seeing that over 8,000 people had visited the site in 2 weeks, because I've been really busting my, my life almost to get this stuff out there. It's been like, you know, this is a huge story. The media is not going to cover this. We've got to do our own part as activists to get the story out. And, you know, no one's there to pick up the ball, and no one's, you know, there to pick up the bat and hit the ball. You've got to go and strike a home run yourself, you know. So this whole thing was just like, okay, you need to get over your fear of public speaking and get on the radio. And I don't care how many times you say, just get the story out, you know. So it's
well,
kind of been like just flying by the seat of your pants, you know?
Well, you
literally
actually, I mean, you took a course in public speaking. I mean, you are dedicated to this, and I find that so amazing, refreshing, and admirable that you are trying to hone your skills.
I think when people realize there are people that are getting microwaved in their sleep from this technology, and people are getting killed, people are suiciding to get out of this technology, and when they see that, when they hear these stories, when they see the testimonials that are coming in, I mean, I cannot sit by and not do this work. This is something that somebody has to do. Somebody has to get online and do this stuff and get this out where people can hear the story, because there are people that are dying for this cause, you know? This is a fact. This is I would never have been able to have made the story up. This is unbelievable what they're doing to people. They're torturing people in their sleep 24/7, you know. So somebody's got to do something.
Yeah. Well, today I spoke with a friend who has. She's going through a real bad time now. And, you know, there's so many people who may have Morgellons and they don't know what it is. They have all kinds of different symptoms depending on the person. When we usually think of it, we think of the fibers, but there's more to it than that. And it's, you know, people are really suffering from.
Yeah, they are.
And people, of course, don't have insurance. I mean, I was telling her, because of what's going on with her, she really needed to get to the emergency room, and she doesn't have insurance. She said that with this Obamacare, the emergency rooms are doing less and less as far as helping, that they would just refer you sometimes. So I don't know. I mean, I've been very fortunate. Years ago when I was needing insurance, they were always there for me, but that evidently isn't the case now. And so And you talk to a real life person who's got this going on because of something stupid that the government did. You know, that just starts to get that infuriating thing. It's like, how dare they do this to, and they're doing it all the time. So,
yeah, it's unbelievable what's going on, and the fact that no one is claiming responsibility for this. There's no one stepping forward and saying, hey, we're spraying y'all. You know, nobody's coming forward and telling us a thing. But yet we're seeing it on a daily basis in some places. You know, Las Vegas is completely riddled with chemtrails, and San Diego has had a lot. And I see photos passed through Facebook every day from Vancouver and my friends in Canada and my friends in Europe. And, I mean, everybody's on board trying to get photos plastered everywhere where people can see this is what's going on in their area on a daily basis.
I saw the one in Iceland.
Oh, my gosh.
That was just, that blew my mind. Some friends of mine moved to northeastern Tennessee about 9 or 10 years ago, and the skies were clear and beautiful, and sort of the foothills, Appalachians, whatever, I know mountains are out west. I don't consider the hills in the east mountains, but you know, whatever. So they've got beautiful scenery. And now they've got chemtrails all over the place, like every day.
Oh, man.
You know, it's
yeah.
The other few weeks ago, I was in Ohio, southeastern Ohio, for a festival. And the morning we were leaving, just looked up and saw like one, and I pointed it out to one of my friends. And they said, oh, look. And they were crisscrossing across the whole sky. And this is in a pretty rural, well, actually very rural area. And, you know, you just don't expect to see that. But they were there. So I don't know. I mean, all we can do right now is try to get people to be aware so that they can do some kind of action. But if you know about it, you can't do anything. So you are definitely doing your share, just writing and getting it out there. And then you're doing an awful lot, Cynthia. And
well, thanks, Bruton. You're doing a lot just by helping us broadcast this and pulling this part together, because without your show and a format to get this out, people don't know. They won't hear about this. So you're giving us a voice and a way to say this. So thank you for doing your part.
Well, I think this is why alternative media is so important. Because like you say, you're not going to get it from mainstream media. It's just not going to happen. So any kind of alternative media, I just urge people to support. Blogs, shows, you know, please, because trust me, nobody doing this is making have that passion. Like you said, now you can sleep because you're working on it and you're getting it out there. So, you know, it's labor of love for humanity is what I think it is.
It's kind of an internal type thing. It's almost like this clock just going off, like, wake up, you know. Wake everybody else up, you know. Let everybody know. And it's
you know, the thing is with climate change and everything, like, we don't have 300 people to start to see the light. We really fast. And so I think that's part of this driving thing. I mean, people are just devoting their time to it. And I think it's important.
Yeah, so many of my friends have even chosen electively not to have kids after 9/11. They were like just paralyzed in their own life. Like, how can I bring kids into the world after something like this happened, knowing what I know with research and stuff like that? So people are very involved in this. A lot of people have made, you know, tremendous personal sacrifices over what they know and how concerned they are about what's really going on with the chemtrails, with psychotronic weapons, you know, all this stuff. So
well,
it's amazing.
That was a choice I made before that. Quite a bit of it. I feel that there's enough food and things on the planet currently to take care of. I think we don't need more people, and I need to keep the corporations from controlling all of these, whether it's Monsanto companies, like that idiot guy who deserves water, they need to pay for it kind of thing. So that's why I just, for the planet's sake, I don't want to bring children in. I think we have enough children who need homes the way it is. So I don't want people who decide they're going to populate the world. So I understand where your friends are coming from. It's just not it's not the best thing to do. But I understand also, I mean, just that they're afraid to get that. So
right.
We're going to let you go, and you will be back on Monday at...
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah, at 5 o'clock Pacific and 7 o'clock Central, Monday, the Research Rabbit Hole with Cynthia Hamill. So, thank you.
Thank you so much, Ruthann. Thank you for the interview. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And now we're here for Palestine. We have Raymond Blaine on Palestine. Hi there.
Hello, everybody. Good afternoon today. This is Raymond Blaine on Palestine. My first story tonight is kind of it's about a librarian group that went to Palestine over June 23rd to July 4th, and they're calling for a boycott to stop the erasure of Palestinian culture and history. So I'll get right into that. As I said, they traveled there June 23rd to July 4th, 2013. They come from the U.S., Canada, Sweden, Trinidad and Tobago, and Palestine. And they bore witness to the destruction and appropriation of information in the myriad ways access is denied. We were inspired by the many organizations and individuals we visited who resist settler colonialism in their daily lives. We connected with colleagues in libraries, archives, and related projects and institutions in the hope of gaining mutual benefit through information exchange and skill sharing. We learned about the common and unique challenges we both face in different parts of Palestine and in our home context. In all our travels and work, we respected the Palestinian civil society for the call of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel and did not partner with any organization that violates this call. As librarians and archivists, as people who believe in access to information, we affirm that the institutional, academic, and cultural boycotts are an appropriate response to the curtailed freedoms and are effective tools for change. Their group was small in scope and limited. They traveled only to Palestine and only to parts of Palestine. They were not able to visit Palestinian communities in Gaza, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, or elsewhere, and their trip was only the first step in creating a network of information workers. It says, we are privileged to visit cities, villages, and refugee camps and to meet with grassroots activists and institutional representatives in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and 1948 Palestine, Israel. We engaged with librarians and archivists about the projects and their struggles. Okay, as they traveled, they saw barriers to movement everywhere, walls, checkpoints, turnstiles, metal detectors, segregated roads, surveillance watchtowers, military patrols, security cameras, and settler militias. They saw communities devastated by criminalization and incarceration. They visited the rubble of villages that were destroyed in 1948. And they witnessed the ongoing Judaization of Palestinian communities through new housing developments, unequal provisions of municipal services, and the Hebrewization of place names. We saw new Israeli settlements hovering on hilltops above Palestinian villages, evidence of the forcible land grabs and displacement that Palestinians have been facing for decades. We met families that have struggled and suffered through egregious violence and yet work every day to secure education, opportunities, safety, and a more just world for their children. the erasure of Palestinian culture and history as a tactic of war and occupation, a means to further limit the self-determination of the Palestinian people. Yet the richness, beauty, and complexity of Palestinian existence was everywhere evident in the historical and contemporary cultural material produced by writers, poets, journalists, artists, archivists, and librarians, and in the histories passed down through stories from person to person. We bore witness to a culture of resistance with all its myriad forms, resoundingly refute the notion that Palestine does not exist. Our experience in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and 1948 Palestine were complex, challenging, beautiful, and deeply meaningful. We met creative, committed, and courageous activists, visionaries, cultural workers, artists, librarians, and archivists. Everywhere we went, we witnessed the daily lived realities of occupation and colonialism, as well as the ongoing resistance and the persistent quest for justice. Okay, so then they go to all these refugee camps. So I'm just going to go through these and what they saw. These are kind of cool. So at the Ada refugee camp located in Bethlehem, we saw how the apartheid wall prevented the community from accessing nearby olive groves, which had been used for relaxation, studying, animal grazing, and agriculture. We also heard about the Lagey Center's project to map the people's histories of the camp. In Nabu Saleh, weekly nonviolent demonstrations against the confiscation of communities' land and water are met with extreme violence from the Israeli military. The villagers are using video to document the violence they experience, as well as collecting the empty tear gas canisters and shell casing, which are used against them. This documentation is used by the community to honor their resistance, communicate their struggle with the wider world, and dispute false accusations in the courts. School librarians described the difficulty in obtaining Arab language children's literature, especially in 1948 Palestine. Many of the available books are low-quality translations from Hebrew, and Palestinian children have little access to their own literary history. We visited the destroyed town of Sofri and heard from former resident Abu Arab about his experience fleeing the town as a child during the Nakba. Abu Arab has a museum of Palestinian material culture, which he developed out of his work as an antique collector. The museum challenges the process of ethnic cleansing and the eraser of the cultural memory. Abu Arab is the brother of poet Taha Muhammad Ali. So there's people, they still are out there, you know, they've collected the stuff and they're hanging on to it, so that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Throughout Palestine, we encountered cultural production by youth to preserve traditions by the Yaffa Youth Movement in Jaffa, the Yaffa Cultural Center in Balada Refugee Camp, and the Lady Center in Ada Refugee Camp. I think they do that a lot of times in Gaza, too, to kind of act out kind of the things that they've witnessed for therapy reasons, which is horrible, but I guess it really helps. Okay, and they witnessed the documentation of prisoners' lives, a central experience in the Palestinian struggle against occupation. At the Nabas Public Library, we saw the Marginalia and Creative Book Repairs in Former Prison Library Collection, and at the Abu Jihad Museum for the Prisoner Movement Affairs. We learned about a project to collect and digitize prisoners' notebooks from across the West Bank. So they're going to digitize these people's journals that have been in these horrible, horrible prisons. I can only imagine what's going to come out of that. It's really interesting to see how that goes. Yeah, well, I mean, we can only guess, but I just thought it would be nice. Okay, they learned from the Atamir Prison Support and Human Rights Association that the Israeli military is currently detaining 4,900 Palestinians, including 236 children and 8 members of the Palestinian legislature. Could you imagine if they had 8 members of the Israeli legislature in Palestinian jail? That would go over really, really well, wouldn't it?
Oh, we'd hear a lot of until they let them go.
This is crazy. Okay, so in East Jerusalem, they visited the Nashahabi Center for Cultural and Literature, a rebuilt family library, which all the books were stolen during the Nakba in 1948. We also visited the Orient House, which was closed by the Israeli government in 2001 and has significant portions of its archival collections confiscated. Yeah, so they're really trying to erase the history. Okay, so librarians at the Bizet University told us that their success in petitioning the Library of Congress to adopt a unique call number for the first intifada, and it's DS 128.4. During a meeting with the organization Al-Quahas for Sexual and Gender Diversity in Palestine Society. We learned about the process of organizing across the West Bank, 1948 Palestinian border, the articulation, Palestinian-specific understandings of sexual identity, and the Singing Sexuality Project, which discusses sexuality through music, which is kind of cutting edge for an Arab society.
Mm-hmm.
In Lid, not from Tel Aviv, we saw where the library of the local school was removed and replaced with a police station. That was lovely by the Israelis. Yeah. Local school library removed a place to put a police station in. Seems fair. We visited the Wadi Hilliya Information Center in Silwan, where residents of the neighborhood create grassroots media about the settler violence they experience on a daily basis. And every day there's something on Silwan. Those people are really living a hell life, but they just keep hanging on. So give them a lot of credit for putting up with what they put up with. I don't know how they do it. And then at the Berea, El Berea Municipal Library, we learned about the Tamer Institute, which produces and publishes Arabic language children's books that are distributed to libraries and community centers throughout Palestine. So that's kind of cool. They got, you know, this Tamer Institute, so they're starting to make way with the Arabic books, but there's still not enough of them. Okay, and so it says, while the delegation has ended, our work will continue. We will seek out and convene events in our home communities where we can share our knowledge about the effects of occupation and colonialism on libraries, archives, and Palestinian society. We'll publish reports, articles, and zines that document the challenges faced and the amazing work being done by Palestinian information workers. We will develop an international network of information workers to facilitate skill sharing, solidarity work, and community among librarians and archivists in Palestine and abroad. We will lobby national and international library and archival organizations to take tangible steps against the occupation and in support of Palestinian perspectives in information and work. We will join Palestinians, Israelis, and international activists in campaigns for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israeli apartheid and colonialism. We will continue to learn and adapt our strategies to the changing realities and will engage in critical examinations of our own positions of privilege. Through these activities, we will work to support access to information in and about Palestine and Palestinian self-determination. And that was Librarians and Archivists to Palestinian in the 2013 delegation. And if you go to Mondo Weiss, you can pull that up, and that was from August 5th. So that's really good. And then it has the list of all the librarians that went. And it was, let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There was like 12 of them. And they can only go in small groups. So they probably went a couple at a time, because if you bring a big group in, then they start asking stupid questions, and then they don't let you in. Because they don't want you to go and do this kind of stuff. You don't want you to find this stuff and expose it, you know, to the outside world that this is actually going on. So, you know, this is a really good article to read. I'm going to definitely be contacting some of these people for that project I spoke of last week. So things are going to looking up. And I think by finding this little article here, I think it was just a sign that says we need to do this for these kids and these people, not just the kids, but the adults too. And get on language speaking center for these kids.
Those librarians saw a lot.
Yeah, they were there for a long time, you know, for like 2 weeks. Really not that long for as many places as they visited.
But I'm thinking, yeah.
I mean, they really scoured the place. I don't know if they broke up into groups and did it, or I kind of think that's probably how they did it. They probably went in 2-3 at a time to not bring attention to themselves, and then they each had an area that they wanted to hit. And that's just my guess, but, you know, you guys can get a hold of these people and write them letters and ask them, how'd you do it? You know, I'm sure that they'd love to hear from you, because it's great to get this information out, and also to talk about the erasure of Palestinian people. That's crazy. I think they're not only running them off, but they're trying to erase them from history. That's scary. So scary. It's so draconian. Yeah, so... So that was the first one. I mentioned another thing about Roger Waters. He got into a little bit of hot water a couple weeks ago. Not that I think it's hot water for me because I think it's great. But he has a pig that he flies around at his concerts, and when he does the song Animals, and so he was flying it around, and it had all the different corporate jackasses in the world, the Shells, the Exxons, the McDonald's, the different people that are, you know, screwing us over, poisoning us, poisoning our water, doing all those things that, you know, I can't even believe is happening, and nobody's saying much. But in the middle of all that was an Israeli flag. And so everybody was appalled because, oh, my God, a Jewish flag on the pig.
God,
no, you got to call it what it is.
I love him.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
I think all us Palestinian activists do. Yeah. So, and it was just a small piece of it. I mean, it was covered in all these symbols, you know, of the repressive governments all over the world. And nothing was ever said about that, like the Saudi Arabian flag and stuff like that. That was nothing said about that. But, boy, that Jewish flag, it popped out like a freaking sore thumb, and everybody had a big fit about it. And I just think it's funny that they got nothing. They're reaching, people. They are reaching.
They are.
So now he's an anti-Semite. But, you know, I'm going to repeat this. I've probably said this before. If anybody knows what an anti-Semite is, an anti-Semite is not necessarily a Jew. An anti-Semite is anyone that speaks Hebrew or Arabic, period. It has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with language. So every time they say, I'm an anti-Semite, you're an anti-Semite, that's not true because we aren't anti-Arabic speakers or
exactly.
anti-Hebrew speakers.
Exactly.
We're anti-Zionist. Being an anti-Zionist is not being an anti-Semite. That's not it. Nobody can tell me that it is and it's not. So they really hide behind that, people. So just remember that. But anytime you hear anti-Semite, find out if they're discriminating against a Hebrew or an Arab-speaking person, then they're an anti-Semite. But if they're anything else, they're not. They're just speaking their mind, and this is just their way to hide behind it so they can continue to bring up the Holocaust, which they are perpetrating on a whole other society of people, worse than Hitler, because they're backed by the largest, most powerful country in the world. So...
Yeah,
way worse than Hitler. Way worse.
Play that. That's what's called.
So methodical.
Yeah.
And so, I don't agree with what happened there, and I don't agree what happens here. So I can speak that way because I feel horrible for both situations, not just one of them. Both situations have never happened. Period. And this should not continue to go on. Especially by people that had such horrible things happen to them. Makes no sense to me whatsoever. So I got another story here. This is also from Mondelez. Do Israelis want a real Palestinian state? And the polls say no. Now I'm going to let Sarit comment on that when she comes on because you know she knows a lot of people. And so this could be very skewed. But then again, this is a Middle Eastern Arab-leaning paper. So... who knows what their agenda is here, but so I just wanted to throw that out there that, you know, there's some type of agenda here.
Yeah,
okay,
I went
so it's peace process. Go ahead.
No, I did want to ask her that, too.
Yeah. Okay, so it's a peace process time again, and with it comes the trope that Israelis are ready for a two-state solution. That sentiment is accompanied by polls showing the same, that Israelis support the principle of two states for two people. But an examination of Israeli polls show that nothing like a viable Palestinian state that would be acceptable to the Palestinian population is on the table. With the peace process in overdrive, media consumers have been treated to a lot of hopeful thinking. In the past month, journalists and analysts have lined up to say that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has the support of the Israeli people to make a peace deal if he would just go ahead and buck his right-wing coalition. Writing in Foreign Policy, Brent Salzi says that there is a majority support including among Jewish Israelis, for talks and for final settlement. One recent poll found that 62% of Israelis support the two-state solution. In a piece on why there's hope for a two-state deal, the Republic's Ben Birnbaum writes that two-thirds of Israelis, including a majority of Likud and Jewish home voters, would support a peace deal that gave a Palestinian a state on 100% of the West Bank with land swaps with its capital in East Jerusalem. The Guardian, Michael Koren, similarly writes that Israelis strong support a two-state solution. All three of these analysts link to an article in Haaretz and the Jerusalem Post that provide details on the same poll. A December 2012 study conducted by S. Daniel Abraham Center for Middle East Peace, showing that right-wing Israelis would support a Palestinian state. The polls, there were two in total commissioned by the center, surveyed by the Habadi Hadu and Likud voters, and found that the majority of them would support a Palestinian state. Conflict solved. Not so fast. The devil is in the details when it comes to a Palestinian state.
Yep.
As Haaretz, Barak Rav reports, the Palestinian state accepted by these right-wingers would be demilitarized, and the kicker is that Israeli keeps all of the settlement blocks in this imagined deal. That means that the settle of Mal, Adnu, and Ariel, two settlement blocks that are considered consensus settlements or settlements that Israeli believe they will keep in a permanent peace agreement. Both Mal, Abdin, and Ariel slice and dice the West Bank into pieces that take a viable Palestinian state off the table. And that's just talking territory. Never mind the discussion about demilitarized state. The Mal'ah Admun was established to break Palestinian contiguity. So this whole settlement was completely established and only to just break up Palestinian continuity. But we have to keep this. We want a two-state solution. Jackasses. Kashrill, the mayor of the settlement, said in 2004, and even the leaders of Palestine, and that's what he said. This mayor actually said it was to break Palestinian community. So they haven't admitted it.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay,
and even the leaders of the Palestinian Authority, who have shown themselves willing to give Israel a lot of resistance to deal with, that would keep Ariel in the hands of the Israelis. As the Palestinian paper showed, the same goes for the Palestinian population at large, especially since Ariel sits on top of a major water resource that once was in Palestinian hands. Okay, a more recent poll conducted in June 2013 and cited by Salzi found that 62% of Israelis would support a two-state solution. But the same poll states that about 54% oppose dismantling most of the West Bank settlements. Both the specifics of which settlements Israel opposes dismantling are missing from the polling data, because they wanted to make it gray and vague. We don't really have borders. What? We'll just sprinkle some pixie dust, and it'll all be okay.
Right.
Alrighty then. So this is the quote-unquote peace process that they're trying to shove down the Palestinian people's throats. Buy off the Palestinian leadership to make them do it.
Yeah.
It's not going to work.
Yeah.
Okay, so then it may be, as Salsa wrote, that public opinion in Israel historically followed leaders' efforts when they pushed major decisions on war and peace. But when you have a leader like Benjamin Netanyahu, who has vowed that Ariel and Mal'ah Admun will remain in Israeli hands forever, there isn't much cause for optimism. And a brand new poll concludes that 63% of Israeli Jews are opposed to withdrawing to the 67 borders. The poll also shows 58% of Israelis opposing a peace agreement in which Israel has to dismantle some of its settlements, but gets to retain Ariel and Mal'ah Admun. So they don't want to dismantle any of them, of course. So what are we even talking about? I don't even know. Taken together, the polling data shows that Israelis are decidedly not interested in a peace deal that would give Palestinians a viable state of their own. It's a depressing fact that the steadfast believers in the peace process refuse to acknowledge. If they did, they have to concede that Israeli society is too wedded to the continuing colonist nation of Palestine for a Palestinian state to come into being. So, yeah, pretty crazy stuff. I didn't expect miracles on this anyway, but what sucks is it just continues to just drag on and gives no, you know, makes it look like they're really trying, but they're really not. They're just trying to just push the Israeli agenda on a population that's being crushed and is trying to be erased, like I read about with their history. You know, they started with their villages, then they went with their history. Now they're, you know, they now no state, you know, no country, no, it's all Palestine, so they can just forget about their stupid thoughts. It's all occupied land. It's all illegal under international law. It's not something that I made up. It's something that's been gone over and over and over and over again. And I don't know how, I mean, what did Iraq, they scouted, or they flouted one UN resolution and were bombed into it. It's just never, never land, and their leader was murdered. And Israelis flaunted 40, 50, 60 of these UN resolutions, and nothing is ever said or done. They ruined Iraq country for one UN resolution and then didn't even find what they said they were looking for because that wasn't the reason they were there to begin with.
Exactly.
And so how can these guys just continue to get away with it? And the answer for me is that it's just a completely criminal organization that is right in the debt back pocket of our Congress. And until we get a handle on our politicians and our political actors, you know, action groups and such, we're going to have problems with this. And they don't care about America. They don't care about anything that does with America. They will sell us up the river as quick as shit. They will not. They are not here to defend us or anything. We give them billions of dollars for no reason other than to test weapons on civilian populations. And that's my rant.
Well,
that's Raymond Blaine on Palestine this week.
But it's all true. It's maybe a rant, but everything you're saying is true.
It is, and all you got to do is research it to find out that it's true. And you're going to go there and find out that it's true. And be careful when you go, because it's not a nice place. It's dangerous for Palestinian activists, or even people that ask questions. You go ask the wrong questions, you end up in jail. And, I mean, you could be completely innocent of anything. You might not even be an activist, but you might have a question. Well, what's over there? They don't want you to know what's on the other side of that wall. That's nothing. That's none of your concern.
Or
and
taking
so,
pictures is it can be quite dangerous.
Yeah, it's frowned against. And, you know, over history, you know, war photographers are definitely big time their targets because nobody wants their crimes to be documented and archived. And war is a crime no matter what, whether it's state sanctioned or not. It's crime. It's criminal. It's death. It's destruction. It's killing people. It's, you know, ruining families, destroying livelihoods. And in this case, with Palestine, everything that moved was a target. And then their infrastructure completely destroyed.
Right.
So,
or if it didn't move,
coolest occupation
all
ever.
Of the trees.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't have to move.
No.
Whatever. So.
Yeah, and you know, and then to take out like you know their food processing centers, like where their chicken farms are, and their dairy farm, and their you know their beef and their whatever they had to eat, and then polluting all their farmland. I mean, running tanks through farmland isn't good.
Yeah.
And then they bomb it with, you know, depleted uranium. They say, oh, they fired, you know, fired missiles, but, you know, or shells, but they landed in open areas. Well, those open areas were farmland. And if they don't explode, then they've got these unexploded ordnance buried in the ground. So they go to farm this stuff and get blown up later.
Right. Or the kids go running to the plane and they, die.
Yeah, you know, or the cluster bombs that they like to drop that were abandoned under international law that they still continue to use. And the white phosphorus that pollutes the environment and burns people beyond recognition that's against international law. I could go on and on. I mean, it's like, wow, why do they get a pass? Who gave them the pass?
Well, look at the canisters. It says made in U.S.
Yeah, made in the United States. It's paid for by my tax money, you know. And that's pretty sickening, too. I don't know how to get away from not paying taxes. But, you know, you got to pay. And I got to pay to help take care of people, too, here in this country. I mean, there's enough of us here that are hurting. But it's sad that our schools are collapsing and we give all this money to a rogue nation that is just hell-bent on world destruction and, you know, hegemony. So I don't know. I don't know, Ruth. We're going to keep on trying. We're going to keep pushing. We're going to keep helping kids and families and all these people over there. And keep educating people. And
right. And I want, whenever you're doing anything about the library/cultural center, let us know, Blaine.
Yeah. I will. Every week I'll have some kind of report on that. I'm going to start working on it here very shortly. So I'll keep you guys all posted and give you guys the step-by-step on how it's going. And you guys can kind of watch its progress as well.
Yeah, because, well, I want to help. I want us to be able to do what we can. So,
it's going to be wonderful if I can pull this off. It'd be great.
Yeah.
And,
I mean,
and like they said, trying to bring back the Palestinian history that they're trying to erase.
Yes.
You need to bring
it
back faster than they erase it. Before it's erased and gone forever.
Yeah, because we need that. I mean, just erasing history.
I mean, isn't that what the Taliban was doing in Afghanistan that everybody was so up in arms about? erasing
right,
the history
yeah.
and the art and all that of
that,
the
that
Afghanistan
was bad.
People.
But if you
that was horrible. But they're doing the same thing. They're digging under Alaska. They're destroying, you know, 1,000-year-old homes and 100-year-old homes and bulldozing them for car parks. And come on. So they're doing the exact same thing in the Taliban. And so there you go. I'll give you another example. And I'll we'll just compare them to another horrible group of freaking individuals. Extremist is bad, period. Jewish extremism, Christian extremism, Arab extremism, all bad. None of it's good. And
fanaticism.
They're the epitome
yeah.
of Jewish extremism. Fanaticism and, the one, One world, one people, everybody. I'm going to get off here and let Sarit take over. One world, one people. This is Raymond Blaine on Palestine and in solidarity, Ruth. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye now.
Bye-bye. Well, Sarit.
Hi.
Blaine had a lot to tell us, and he wanted to ask you, and I did too, as soon as I saw this, there was an article out, I think it was, I believe, from Press TV, but I'm not sure, saying, what's the music?
I turned it off.
Okay. It was saying that over half of the Israelis port going back to the pre-1967 borders. Do you or not?
We're getting cut off. Are you asking about the 67 borders?
Yeah.
Half of the Israelis want that very badly.
They want the pre-1967.
Yes.
Because that over half of them don't want to go back to that.
Yeah, and the half that want to go back to that are divided into a group that would rather have a one-state solution.
Okay, because, I mean, that's where there's, and, you know, that, and just make that Blaine did talk a bit about that, but what else has been going on this week in the area?
Okay, there's been big protests because they're kicking the Bedouin out of the Negev.
Yeah.
So there many Israelis and Bedouin and whoever went and protested in a very nonviolent manner, mostly holding signs up and asking. It's called the Prior Plan or Prior Plan or something. They do not want to be leaving where they always lived. So the Israeli media is reporting. Instead of talking about what is actually happening, they're demonizing the Bedouin now and saying how bad they are in smuggling drugs or bringing crime. They reported that the lie that us protesters or my friends attack the police to wipe out any sympathy among the regular person.
Of course. I mean their media is just like the media here. It lies. It reports what the government and the corporations tell it to report.
Absolutely.
What's
the difference between them and here? Let me see. Everything is the same. Reality TV shows, dumbing down of the people, austerity, taking away their education, taking away their health care, taking away any social. Oh, you know, not just we have election at the same time, but when we raise the age of retirement there, at the same time they did it here, or talks
really?
About it here.
Really?
Yeah, everything's. The governments are so connected. There are. I learned from one of the Israeli groups that I'm at that Bibi is a CIA agent. It's just a business. They just want to take Palestine and sell it to the rich corporations because they have a lot of natural gas in Palestine and minerals, like the mineral for the Dead Sea. I forgot what it's called, but it's used to create fertilizer in China, which helps Chinese people have great agriculture.
I've been studying
about this too much.
I mean, it's like I'm I'm almost laughing because it is so horrifying.
Isn't it?
And
we know they're going to do that everywhere until nobody's left, just business. You know that movie? Yeah, there's movies about this scenario happening. They're warnings, but most people have no time.
About movies, I'm like people who know me know I'm very musically and movie deprived. So I just don't know what the movies would be. But
I will send it to you. Yes.
Okay.
There's a movie about humanity 500 years ahead from now, and everyone is seriously dumb.
Yeah.
And the law school is in Costco's.
Well, they're dumb. And like you were talking, you know, that Jewish, quote unquote Jewish people, there's a lot of intellectuals there. And so, you know, I mean that was still in my brain. And my ex is Jewish and quite the intellectual. And so I'm like, okay. Then when you come down and you were talking to me today about the Israeli people just across the board are in reality shows and getting totally dumbed down. And I thought, my God, just what you just now said, though, if it's happening there, it's happening here. So I guess we can't separate the two countries now. They're both
no,
the same.
They're the same.
Yeah. But, I mean, I'm sad that nobody there held out against the reality shows, okay? Because to me, those things are just, I don't even have words for them. And the fact
I agree.
That they believe that those are real, you know, it's like,
I agree.
Me, you're stupid.
And they started when fascism totally took off in 2001. That's when we got flooded with reality TV shows.
Yeah, and they're anything but real. But people believe it, and
yeah, they're scripted.
And, I haven't watched. I mean, I hear about them from people who actually watch them, and you know, I just yell at them, and it makes me feel better. It doesn't do anything, but I feel better yelling. It's like, well, you know, why are you spending your time? And it's not enough for them one a week. You've got to watch, like,
exactly. Actually, I met a nice guy that likes to watch those shows, and he was a friend of mine, and I noticed that the only reason he could watch those shows is because the doctor put him on Xanax.
Ah. Okay.
And all right. I think once you're on Xanax, you will take what they give you.
Okay, you have a very.
And how many Americans are on medication? Oh, they're putting the Israelis on Xanax too.
Okay.
Which is a drug that was invented for prisoners of war.
It to there again, just sort of dumb, not much in the way of emotions anymore, just sort of zombie-ish.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's a great
All
point.
All these drugs are affecting people. Without those drugs, a lot more people would revolt.
Okay, that's it. And oh yeah, I mean the and just people that I know, and I'm appalled when I find out.
They're in pain and don't know what to do.
Right.
That's why they take it.
And it's
sad.
But you know, if I just don't. There's got to be will, but it's all connected. Because you know they're eating bad, they're eating animals and animal products. You know the animals have been tortured. The animals have eaten horrible things, injected with horrible things, which goes
absolutely
into the human body, and all those extra toxins in them.
Oh yeah,
strictly GMO foods, which again they have all those toxins. Their immune system is for shit, and so if you really feel bad physically, you're going to get depressed. Then they go, they get these medications. And like you said, then there they are watching reality TV.
Yeah, I think that you got to the point here.
That I find that very sad. And the fact that I used
maybe higher than the average country with intellectual people, and to find out that they're right in there with it. I mean, I used to think the percentage there would be higher, but they're watching the same shit.
They are.
There was some kind of a show, it was so stupid, but some kind of a reality show that evidently there was a rumor that it might go off, and it turned out that people were on the streets if it did.
Really?
Do you? I'm sure it was you that told me they were there was some show that's so popular there.
Oh, the Big Brother show.
Okay, a reality
show. Since I don't live in Israel anymore, I don't really know about the Big Brother show, but I see angry comments of my, I have 500 Israeli friends on Facebook. I see angry comments in Hebrew. How dare he sexually harass her on the show? That was a crime. Did you see how people in Israel cheer to that? It's totally destroying their culture even more. To normalize sexual harassment or assault.
Like it's just a joke.
Assault is just a joke.
Right, just smirk, smirk, wink, wink kind of thing.
And it just makes me feel sad for the Palestinian women.
Right.
Because I know they're the ones who get the real bad side of it.
They have them coming in contact, and especially with the soldiers, because they just have no place they can go.
Absolutely.
There's nobody.
I wish people, like normal people, understood that aspect of being occupied is that any soldier can rape you and there's nothing you can do about it. If you complain, you probably die.
Well, that's it. Or if your husband or child or somebody tries to stand up for you or killed,
they can die.
Put in prison. But see, that's one of the rules of war and occupation, is to rape the women and children because it makes the men feel emasculated, because the men feel so depressed that they couldn't stand up for their women and kids. And so
that must be terrible.
That psychological. And Democratic Republic of the Congo, the DRC, that I read about that because that's like the rape capital country of the world. And that's what they... Their soldiers and their, but you go into a village, and because then that demoralizes the men. You know, there you are.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we don't expect country, but we wouldn't expect that from a country that bills themselves as the first world. But, you know, I was talking with somebody recently. And we pretty much came to the conclusion there's no more first world countries, hardly.
No, they hardly. Maybe some countries in South America
and maybe
Finland, Sweden. Yeah, Scandinavia.
Exactly. That's it. Up there and down there. But as far as like the U.S., which used to be such a first world, yada yada, it really, I think it can't claim that title anymore.
I do feel better living in the U.S. than in Israel because I don't get sexually assaulted all the time here.
Okay. I mean, I could see that because that's what happened to you there. Yeah.
And men are much more polite here to women. Of course you see bad things, but it's not as bad here. Actually, it's actually a difference of night and day.
Isn't that crazy?
I've been all over the U.S. too.
Yeah, me too. And I've always been treated with respect. I can't fault our countrymen for that.
I didn't even notice that women have less rights until a couple of years ago. I didn't even notice it.
Well, women have career opportunities in this country that they don't in other countries. And
absolutely.
There's still the difference in pay. I mean, we have that going on. But as far as the opportunity seems to be here pretty much.
And
it's getting better here.
Yeah. And that doesn't mean that the women aren't all really well in what kind of a profession they decide to go into, because they may be badly picked on, whatever, by the men, or have to do extra work or whatever. And I'm not saying any of that's right. At least
they're
not a foot in the door for those who come after, maybe, which you don't get in a lot of other countries, for sure. So, I mean, that is something to be grateful for.
What bothers me about Israel is I go in their groups a lot, and there's not a lot of people from the left on their groups who dare to speak out or something. There are a few. Not enough. I wish the Israeli left would be more out. I guess, you know, they're being targeted by the authorities.
Right.
They're being called for investigations for things they say on Facebook.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Do you think that a lot of them that are in the groups that you're in, are they using their real name? The ones that speak out, are they using their real name?
I don't think all of them are.
Yeah. I mean, you
almost
can't
blame dangerous.
No. Yeah. No, you can't blame them if they decide not to.
A friend of mine, for example, was walking to her apartment, and in the stairway was a policeman, and started questioning her. So she just took him to her apartment and made him coffee and spoke about the occupation.
Oh.
She's very smart and enlightened. So it's all better. She had a good policeman, but what if they don't?
Well, right. I mean, why was he in her?
Exactly. He wasn't waiting for her to come home so he can ask her questions about her activities.
Wow.
And another thing, I was just looking on my Facebook home feed, and there was another girl talking about not wanting to search Arab women when she was in the military. So she had to go to jail. So she went to jail instead.
Wow. Yeah, these are the unsung heroes. So you don't really hear about usually, and who just stand up for what's really right.
Yeah, many of my friends went to jail because they refused to do certain tasks in the military. That's when they wake up, and then they never go back again. They just finish their jail term.
Yeah. The people that, without people like you, we would never hear about them, because there's no media in the cover that.
Even the Tennesseans not allowed to talk about Israel. A reporter from there told me.
That messed up. I mean, we can talk about any country in the world, say anything we want, but don't say it about Israel.
The bosses won't.
Michael says it's not that it's not allowed. The bosses won't print it.
Yeah. Oh, okay, they can write whatever they want, but it's not going to turn up in the paper.
Same thing with Occupy.
Yeah. So that firsthand also. They just have a very new scope, and they want to search in the news.
So I heard Occupy Israel do a protest.
Really?
And it gave me chills, because when they did the mic check, they were talking about a one-state solution with equal rights for all, and I got chills.
God.
There were not a ton of people, maybe 500, but it was beautiful.
That gives me chills. I mean, oh, God, yeah, because we're going to come through this. It may be nearer than we think.
Yeah, you never know. There's all the time protests there. So many protests that you can't keep up for everything because of capitalism is taking over. They're taking away their health care now. They used to have free health care. Not anymore.
I, Wow, but yeah, I had heard that they had free health care.
They're going to lose it. That's pretty harsh.
That you could finally like won something like that. I mean, well, that's what today I was talking with her. She's really ill. I told her to go to the emergency room. You know, she said she doesn't have insurance, and I said, well, they'll do with you. And she said it's not like that now. A lot of times the emergency room won't. They refer you to someone. And
that's true.
And, I mean, I didn't realize it had gotten that bad. And I just don't know what to do for her. I mean, she's seriously ill. And it's, you know, people should not be in this condition.
How awful. Yes, I've known of people who've been very sick here and did not go to the emergency room. In pain and tears and would not go. Because it costs so much money.
Yes, it was. Had to go when I was having issues years ago. I would just doctors would just send me, but they were always really, really good. And if you didn't have insurance, you just, you know, say you don't and that you're responsible, whatever. I mean, I always had excellent care, and the idea that people don't get that now. I mean, when she told me that, God, what are we supposed to do? No, and so Israel is losing. Okay. Well, and the Palestinians never had any, so let's get real.
Yeah, they have to pay for it, don't they? I don't know what they have from healthcare. It depends what their authority gives them. I will ask.
Yeah. In Gaza, there's a lot of things they can't get anyway because if generators don't work, because they don't have electricity for maybe 8 to 12 hours a day in the hospital.
And no water.
And no water. And hope that the generators will go up or gas, whatever. I mean, because those
no
things...
No gas either. Now that Egypt bombed their tunnels, they're in great, great dire situation.
Yeah, you know, we were... Well, when Mubarak was... put out of Egypt, I mean, out of office. You know, we were thinking that Egypt, Palestine, and that didn't happen. And now with more not happening, it has really turned out to be a major disappointment to kiss Israel's ass and the United States. So they've turned out to just be another ineffectual country or actually an enemy of ours. Of Palestine, they really have not done what they could have because they were afraid.
Yes,
know?
Very afraid.
Yeah.
Israel's been acting like a mad dog, bombing Lebanon, bombing Syria, bombing the flotilla, or not bombing them, but shooting them. Also, the fishermen of Gaza, they even shoot them. I mean,
I know.
They
used to be.
I can understand the fear.
They
almost.
Do. I mean, whatever you do, you're going to get shot. They used to have a fishing boundary. Then they made it 7 miles, then 3. So now, even if they're well within the 3 miles, if an Israeli patrol boat comes away, scurry, you know, that's.
Yeah.
Dehumanizing. I don't, but Blaine had talked earlier about some experience that got to visit, you know, the places they were going, and there were 12 of them, but he thought that they probably even smaller groups to these different places, because he said, you know, if you have a group of people, you're apt to be approached or kept from being what you ever. So people still are going to, you know, check things out and get in and look, but you have to just be careful about it.
That is very dangerous because the settlers are very violent, but I really admire people who go. I wish I could go.
Yes, I was going to ask, do you have any plans, Michael, your husband, any plans to go to Israel and visit Palestine?
Not anytime real soon, no.
No.
It's too expensive to even go there, and they don't let everyone in.
I know. I was going to say, yeah, besides the expense, you might not be able to get in anyway.
I wonder if they let me in, yeah.
Yeah. It's, no. Yeah, I don't know what their criteria is.
It's very simple. Sometimes they'll stop in the airport when you're about to go in, and they will ask for your password for Facebook, and we'll see.
I've heard of that, yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
I've heard of it firsthand, yeah. They'll ask for your password, and if you don't want to give it to them, you're leaving.
And then give it to them, you're leaving anyway.
Yeah, so this girl gave it to them, and they saw that she belongs to the Solidarity Movement. So she spends a night in a special jail, then they send her back to the United States. Real fascism.
Right. If anybody's thinking about going, I think a few months ahead of time, you need to clean up your page or get another Facebook page or something.
Yeah.
You
that
know?
Might help.
Yeah. But make it 2 or 3 months. Well, actually, I
have
A friend who was going to Kashmir, and she lived in the country, and she was going to go and stay for, I think, 3 months in Kashmir, and she changed her name on Facebook. She changed everything, and so her old account, she still made all the occupation, but the new account was just in case, you know?
Yeah, so, that's wise.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I recommend to do.
Yeah, you've got to think now. Yeah.
Then keep changing your password because they hack accounts real good.
Exactly. Passwords. Keep adding security things. Yeah, you and I know about hacking.
Yeah, I have to change my password after I speak in the Israeli. What happened is, yeah, after I speak in the Israeli groups, I have to change it or I can't use Facebook.
Is oh god, so all the time. Well, I sign off sometimes twice a day. I do this that a friend that on part of the thing. He said you need to use this all the time. Clean it up. It takes away a lot of stuff.
Yeah, that's very important.
Yeah, that we're doing now. You know, in the good old days. An internet account, and you go on and you do, and then even, you know, a few years ago, you get a Facebook account and do whatever, and that, my God.
Yeah.
It's an ordeal, and I know that it slowed down certain functions are a little bit slower, I mean, just by seconds, but they're slower because I've got all this added stuff. That, you know, I mean, I can tell, but it's I'm not complaining. I'm just saying that, you know, there's always a price, even if it's just in seconds. it's crazy. But, you know, Facebook has been good to us. So we've been able to really meet up with people, get a lot of words out. It's been good to us in spite of all the other parts of it.
It has.
Yeah.
I got to talk to a lot of people from Palestine on Facebook and find out what's really going on there years ago.
Well, that's it. I mean, and you sure you weren't going to learn that from mainstream media?
No. The mainstream media is not to be trusted for anything. MSNBC is owned by General Electric. Fox News is owned by Rupert Murdoch. And now Koch brothers are buying public television, too, or something. There is no free media.
That's why always we urge people support your alternative media, whether it's radio stations, this one, whether it's websites, blogs, whatever. to media. That's where you're going to get the truth.
So, we got so much good alternative media like Democracy Now. I love that.
Yeah, I do too. Our time is up. You'll be back next Tuesday. Okay?
Okay.
So, have a great week.
You too.
Say hi to Michael. I know he's right there. And
he is.
I want him to run for off.
Okay, I let him know. I told him.
Okay.
Run for off.
Good night.
He's laughing. Okay, take care. Bye-bye.